You're listening to an American Theater podcast. American Theater is a publication of Theater Communications Group, www.americantheater.org.
Good afternoon and welcome to Off Script, American Theater's podcasts on all things theatrical. I'm Rob Weinert Kent. My pronouns are he, him. I'm the editor-in-chief of American Theater Magazine, and I'm here with my colleague,
Alexandra Pearson. I'm the associate editor of American Theater Magazine. My pronouns are she, her, and I'm calling in from the land of the Lenape in New Jersey.
And I'm calling in from the land of the Lenape in Queens is where I actually am, although my backdrop looks like I'm in front of the curtain at the opening of The Outsiders, because on today's show, we're happy to have the guests are the Cooperman brothers, who are the choreographers of The Outsiders. They just got Tony nominations, along with many Tony nominations for the show, including director Daniel Tamer and best new musical. Can't wait to talk to them. Ali actually spoke to them. We'll go to that conversation later. We're also going to, after we speak a little bit about what we've been doing, we're going to talk to Brittany Samuel, who's the critic at Broadway News, about this crazy last month and the season leading up to it of. I don't even know the number of openings. I should have that handy. 19, something like that. It was a crazy number of new musicals. And it could have been too much. It might've been too much of a good thing, but we'll talk to Brittany and see how she survived that and what she thought. I want to just note that we have a new issue out. I should have it to show you, but I don't. Our April issue is the audience issue. It's a print magazine. I'm talking about an issue, an actual issue of a magazine in American theater. If you don't have it, please subscribe or go to the Drama Bookshop or the Understudy in Chicago. It's americantheater.org/join to subscribe. I just met with a friend who teaches English and theater at Elon University in North Carolina, did not even know we're back in print. So we've got to spread the word, folks, that we're in print and you got to support us. I can say that we also are still doing a lot online, though. And I want to talk a little bit about the stories we put up online in the last month, since we did our last Off Script. I had a couple conversations with a few artistic leaders, exit interviews and one entrance interview of a sort. Kristen Martin, who was one of the founding artist directors, she is the founding artist director of Here Art Center in New York, one of these most important downtown spaces. It's been around 30 years and she's leaving to make way for new leadership. It was a fascinating conversation that got into the nitty gritty of how much it costs to make even small experimental shows in New York, but also her hope for new artistry and good working conditions for artists to survive. The other one was a sort of a delayed entrance interview with Snehal Desai, who was named artist director of CTG last April. And then 2 months later, they canceled the season at the Taper, which is one of the venues Center Theater Group runs. In any case, they've just announced a pretty exciting season, reduced, but the Taper's back. And the Taper, if you followed me at all, you don't have to, but the Taper and the CTG was a formative theater for me. So to have the Taper back is a great thing. Anyway, spoke to Snehal about his plans for that and about getting that theater back on track. Let's see, Roger Q. There was a wonderful profile of Roger Q. Mason by Africa Sella, one of our Rising Leaders of Color writers. Roger Q. Mason is a playwright whose plays have not been done a lot in New York, but they're being done all over the country. Pride of Lions was at Theater Rhinoceros, closed recently. Lavender Men's gonna be at About Face. I think it might've just opened or is about to open. And then next month, the Duot is gonna be at Philadelphia Theater Company. So check out that really fascinating piece. Roger was on Subtext about a year ago, but this is a catching up with them in a profile. Let's see. We just published this just last week, another Bay Area theater, Golden Thread, pivoted their entire season to plays about and for and written by Palestinians. It's their season of Palestine. And so we had a wonderful Palestinian-American writer herself write the piece about returning to Haifa, which was a play just closed last week, but ran in late April. That's a fairly famous work by Ghassan Kanafani. And I didn't realize when I assigned Maya Nazal, who wrote this piece, that her grandmother knew the author of the piece. So her links to Palestine go deep, and it's a beautiful piece about what that play means to her, but also her hopes for theater that can resist and speak out against the war. I will just plug also Playwright's interview with Brandon Jacob Jenkins and Ebony Booth, whose play Primary Trust is in the April print edition. Only in the print edition, you have to get the magazine to it. But the interview that she did with Brandon Jacob Jenkins about her play and playwriting is a ride, and that's online. It's also in the magazine. I think I've said a lot about a lot of things. Allie, all the things you're going to talk about are things that had a little bit of Broadway to them. So tell me
Yeah,
about
a
the
little
Broadway
bit.
stuff
You
you're
know,
bringing. Yeah.
we don't only cover the Tonys, but we are leading up a little bit, so why
Yes.
not talk about it? But just to say that script looks gorgeous. Primary Trust in the
Oh, yeah.
magazine. Get your hands on that. But
Definitely.
some of the stories a little more Broadway focused that we've been writing lately. I wrote a fairly personal piece, a critic's notebook on the Who's Tommy, which is currently running on Broadway. And transferred from the Goodman Theater in Chicago. I looked at representations of disability, mental illness, deafness, and blindness, and some of the ways that that production leaves out folks with those actual identities. And then a wonderful Detroit writer named
Kianga,
Kianga J.
Kianga Moore.
Moore.
There you go. That's it.
Wrote about Amber Ruffin and some of her updates to The Wiz, which was very fun. Read that one if you get a chance. And just happy news to talk about our spring people to watch. This issue profiled Ingrid Michaelson and Mark Leighton Suthers. Ingrid Michaelson is the composer behind The Notebook, which is also running on Broadway, and Mark Leighton Suthers has his play The Coffin Maker coming up very soon. So check both those out. Rob, did you have anything
Yeah.
else?
Yeah. Just real quick, Mark Leighton Suthers, the Coffin Maker's coming to Pittsburgh Public Theater. And Mark is a real Pittsburgh fixture. I just wanted to mention, yeah, Ali alluded to this. I sort of backed this. Obviously, we cover Broadway, not just because it's fun, but also there are a lot of nonprofits on Broadway. All the best musical nominees this year played at nonprofit, including The Outsiders, played at a nonprofit theater before. Was it the Old Globe, I think, in the case of Outsiders, or La Jolla? It was one of the San Diego theaters.
La
Forgive me, I don't
Jolla.
have it. La Jolla. Okay. Real-time correction there. And four of the five best play nominees were literally playing in Broadway houses. There are four theaters that have Broadway, Tony-eligible Broadway houses, Roundabout, MTC, Second Stage, and Lincoln Center. So three of those were MTC plays, I think. One was Second Stage, Mother Play. And the other one, Stereophonic, came directly from Playwrights Horizon. So nonprofits are all over that. That's not the only reason we write about Broadway. There's also a lot of artists who cross over. And we just noted a few. They may not be coming to Broadway, but there's two new musicals. And if you write a musical in America, you're thinking Broadway probably. So there's a new musical at South Coast Rep called Prelude to a Kiss, based on the play they commissioned from Craig Lucas. They went back and made a musical out of it, and it was at South Coast Rep recently. Also coming up at the Alliance Theater is a musical by Titus Burgess and AZ Dungey of the Preacher's Wife, which is based on The Bishop's Wife, very popular book, movie, and movie with Denzel Washington. So it's been turned into a musical. Plunder wrote about that. So you might look for those in future Broadway seasons. Speaking of Broadway seasons, I want to bring on our colleague Brittany Samuel, who's written for American Theater a few times. Love to have her back. But she's the critic for Broadway News, and she just watched more shows than any human should have to. And she and,
Correct.
and you know,
Correct.
a lot of people see a lot of those shows. I meet theater junkies all over the place, but not all of them have to write about them on Deadline. Brittany, what was this last month like for you?
I kept comparing it to being in a boot camp.
And I might not necessarily be going off to war, but I feel like I trained. It was equal parts thrilling and exhausting, I'd say. It did definitely like strengthen my writerly muscle, if that exists, but it was a lot. It was a lot. There was a point I was talking to my mother and I was like, you know, I too am a suffragette. Like, I'm Russian and I also I'm in a band. Like, I don't know who Britney is anymore. I am all of these other people. I don't know if you knew that, but yeah, it was really intense. But I mean, what better way to be exhausted, I guess.
Sure. It's strange to complain about having to see too much theater, right?
I know. I could not complain to any of my friends who are like in medical and tech fields. It's like, guys, it's like triple openings. You guys just don't get it.
Yeah, because but all the writing too. I mean, that is a job. Writing about it and accounting for it is a job. It's not just sometimes sitting in a play can be feel like a job. Trust as you well know. Was this
especially
your first season?
When you don't like the show, it definitely.
That's right. Was this your first season in this kind of glut? What, the full season?
I would say technically no. I've been writing for Broadway News since before the start of the season. But at the same time, this felt like the first one where it was solely me carrying the season, except for a couple times where I was out of town or sick or what have you. So this felt like my first season in a way. Yeah.
Interesting.
And I'm really lucky that I got to have a first season with Broadway News because I love them. I love my editor over there. It's just a really great, encouraging team. And because they do the Broadway briefing and everything, they're used to being up really late at night and really early in the morning. So it's like, this is working out for us.
So I'm going to get technical here because I know that the old story used to be, and I think they still did this in London for until in my lifetime, in my memory, because I knew some critics there. You literally ran down the aisle back in the old days at the end, at the curtain. You weren't just being rude. You had to go file your story and it would go into the papers later that night. What was your deadline? What does your deadline look like for these?
You know, I see people do that, but I always feel a little weird, like running out that early and before the battles and all that. It's like a weird, I don't know, social politic happening when you're a critic.
Yes.
But no, usually, well, it depends. So my reviews, usually I was filing the morning or afternoon of the day a show opened, essentially. So that was
right.
The day I was going back and forth. So
right, and you had the press previews are no longer than opening night. So you
exactly
press previews. So you had some time, but still must have been a traffic jam.
And all, I mean, there were more than one days where two shows were opening on one day. So
yeah.
That's when things really got intense.
Yeah. I'm sorry, Brittany. You cut out for a second. Can you go back to you said? Like you were talking about deadline and you said my reviews usually, and then it kind of cut out for a bit.
I'm usually filing, let me get this straight. I'm usually filing the afternoon that a show opens later that night. So like I'd submit my first draft. Like let's say I saw a show Wednesday night and it opened on the Thursday. I'd be seeing it Wednesday night, writing into the night or early the next morning, filing that next morning, that next day. And then going back and forth with my editor until publishing that night. Mind you, I also have a part-time day job. I just want to put that out there.
Wow, you are busy. Have you slept? How are you holding it all together?
I wish. Well, I went truly straight from the last show that might have opened was Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
So like went from straight from that. And as I mentioned earlier, I just moved to my first like big girl apartment. So we went from mental exhaustion to physical. So
wow.
Sleep will come. It hasn't come
apartment.
Yet, but it'll come.
Yeah, I'm sure it doesn't feel quite like home yet, but it'll get there. So tell me some of your highs and lows this season in terms of what you've seen.
Oh, it feels mean to say hello, but even though I have them. So let's start with the highs.
Sure.
And where do you even start? I would say performance-wise, I thought Appropriate and Pearly Victorious were the two of the strongest productions I've probably seen in my life, maybe not even in the season. I thought all around those were really, really exceptional, and I'm really glad for all the nominations that they got. I was also really surprised at how much I love The Who's Tommy. And I don't want to sound ignorant because I still haven't read your article yet. It's not personal. There are so many articles I want to read that I haven't gotten time to read yet. Weird thing about writing for Broadway is you stop being able to read your colleagues, and you can't see anything off Broadway, and you can't see anything again. Like, thank God I grabbed another ticket to Lempicka, which, you know, my dark horse favorite. So I was really shocked by how much I love The Who's Tommy. Wasn't super familiar with the music or The Who or anything, but I thought it from a technical perspective, it was really ambitious and really successful. I was actually kind of surprised that they didn't get more technical nominations. And then what else? I mean, honestly, in terms of my personal taste, maybe all that critical muscle aside, Lempicka and The Notebook were two of my favorite times sitting down watching a show. Now, they were two of the worst reviewed shows of the season, which I'm still trying to unpack. But I know that those were two shows where I told myself, not only would I pay to come back, I could sit here for 3 more hours and deal with these women and these stories. Maybe it's something about a woman who paints. I'm like into that. I don't know.
I wonder where you stood on the Cabaret was a very hated show. And I, for some reason, really, I wouldn't say I enjoyed it because it was made not to enjoy. It was made to really pound that show into you. But I was kind of devastated by it. I didn't think the pre-show was necessary. It was a little bit silly, but I didn't mind having a drink, though. I don't know. Where'd you stand on that one?
I think that's interesting that you have that experience, because I think it blurs the enjoyment, because they're like cocktails and, oh, you're in this, you know, nightclub and it's all seedy, but it's also queer and fun. And like, it's supposed to seem like dank and dirty, but it's kind of sexy and elegant at the same time. And then the show is quite crushing, and it's a very different production than, you know, the Cabaret I had in my mind, which that excited me, that I was seeing something so wildly different than, you know, my presumptions. But I think to your point, sometimes all of that, you know, all of those aesthetics, all of that theatricality doesn't always necessarily make the story any stronger. I mean, I think as is, that story is really affecting, and like, my favorite parts were actually Bebe Neuwirth's performance and Counterpart. What's that actor's name?
Steven Skybill, yeah.
Right. And one could argue they have like a simpler, gentler story, and they performed it in a very different way than the leads. And I thought it was 10 times, that was the most impactful part of it for me for the whole show. So, you know, plus I think it's difficult. They were in like a very small playing space. There wasn't a lot of room. There was a lot happening in there.
Interesting.
Yeah. But I thought it was, from a director's perspective, I feel like I thought it was interesting having to work with such small space and still being able to create really impactful moments. I mean, I think about that, you know, no spoilers, but that moment of stepping on the glass, the Jewish tradition, and how it kind of warps into another pivotal scene in the show. I'll never forget that. I was like, oof.
Yeah. I was impressed by that they were able to do all the book scenes on that little stage in the round. Kind of raised the level of difficulty. It made me anxious the whole show about the sight lines. But I kind of, all the anxiety and unpleasantness that show created in me felt like it was part of the experience, was supposed to be there. Of course, a lot of people don't want to go see a show that makes them feel anxious the whole time. But I was with my 14-year-old. It was his first experience of Cabaret. I'm not sure it was the best way to introduce him to the show. He was like, okay, I don't know about that.
Well, 14, I think, is a little hard for Cabaret, but, you know, why not?
He's got to learn, you know.
Yeah.
Tell us about, I'm really interested about Lempicka, because what you loved about it, because, I mean, I didn't see it, unfortunately.
We don't have a lot of time.
I know. Now I have my deadline to go see it. And, you know, I really want to reckon with why you think, you said maybe you just like women painters, but,
yeah.
But seriously, it was a show that really, I wouldn't even say a divided critic. It was mostly negative and a few outliers.
It was extremely negative. And actually, one of the only other critics that reviewed it positively, Jillian Russo, I'm not sure if you know her. She's at New York Theater Guide. We talked and we're like, we're going to go see it again. So we're going. What did I like about it? Oh, can you hear me?
Yep.
Rob's a little for me. It's like, he's just like at the outsiders. I'll keep going though. For me, Olympia, it was really different, extremely different offerings than all the other, I would say, really safe musical theater offerings that I think like were aplenty this season. It was really ambitious. I think a lot of people argued it was overly ambitious, trying to fit too many storylines, modalities, histories, like 70 plus years of this woman's life into a little show. And there's a love triangle, and then there's historical events. It's a lot. But it introduced me to an artist I had never heard of. I thought there was like some meta deliciousness about seeing Eden Espinosa kind of like debut this new role about a woman who was overlooked but then became this star. And like one could argue there's some parallelism with her actual career. Fans of Eden for a long time, like myself, you know, we've championed her for a long time and feels like she's needed this moment. And then, you know, Amory Mon gave like such a vocally indulgent performance that I will never forget. And again, the whole thing, it sounded really different. I compare it to Eurovision. Have you ever watched any of those YouTube videos?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And I was like, yes, 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 yes. There was no point I was watching the show where I was like, no, I really enjoyed it. And I think people should go back and look again with an open mind and not be afraid when a woman is messy and complicated. Like, that's okay. In my personal taste, musical theater does not ever have to be perfect or perfectly executed to be worthwhile. And I thought that show was just really, really ambitious and exceptional in many ways. I stand by it. I stand by it.
That's fine. That's fine. There are two shows that came from the public that I thought were not great at the public or not as great as they could be. Suffs and Hell's Kitchen. Both of them, the reviews were like, oh, it got better. It actually is the full, I mean, it's Suffs.
1,000%. I saw both of those productions at the public as well, and I fully agree.
Okay. So I've not seen those, but I'm heading to Suffs for Mother's Day. Seems like the appropriate show for that. Let's see if my wife actually asked for that as a guest.
Oh, nice.
Let's all go see that. I was curious about the new play nominees, what you thought. There was Zsa Zsa, Mary Jane, and Prayer for the French Republic were all at MTC. They had a really good year for nominations this year. And then there was Mother Play, and of course, everyone's the new darling, Stereophonic. Wonder again, your thumbnail sketch of what?
My thumbnail sketch.
Maybe not review of each show, but like
I'll just say bluntly, like, this is a meet for me. Like I said, I thought a lot of the musicals I saw this year were quite safe. You know, well done, but like very safe. The plays to me were exceptional. Like, many plays this season really blew me away. And I thought, in general, I think it's a stronger and in that sense, probably much more competitive category. I'm not so sure, but again, I said, in terms of new plays, you know, Mother Play really gutted me. Mary Jane really gutted me. Stereophonic, I've loved since it was at Playwrights Horizons, loved it again. Something completely unique. And I don't even know which one I'd really pick if I'm being really blunt.
Okay. Fair enough.
But I think it's also like a great range of different kind of playwrights. Like, we have a Paula Vogel who was like a grand dame and like such a teacher and such an icon. Yeah. With like Jocelyn, who people know, but she's quite young and really new. And Amy Herzog had such a crazy season. Like, it's a good mix of folks and quite a few women in there, which I love.
Yeah, definitely it's a strong year for women playwrights and women directors across the board. It is, while it's certainly sad from that perspective to see Lupita go in terms of a female writer and female director. I mean, again, there's not a one-to-one comparison. It's the show has its own merits, but it's a good season. It's a good season for women if you're measuring by that yardstick.
For sure. I'm pretty sure it's arguably like a landmark season, right? I think we have the most.
I should know that stat, but I think that's right. I think it's the most.
Yeah.
And that wasn't the case even like 5 years ago. It was like, it was more the exception, you know?
Are there any of the nominations that surprised you, either good or bad?
I feel like I haven't had much time to be surprised. I feel like it went from writing to moving. But, that's a good question. I don't know that anyone really surprised me. I mean, yeah, I'd have to think about that for a second. I don't know if any of them really shocked me. I know when my friends were talking about it before I came out, I was like, all I need is, what did I say? I said a Young, a Bean, a Plunkett, and a Paulson. Those were like the four that I was gunning for. And I felt pretty confident they would all be nominated, and they were. So
I want to translate that for our
oh, yeah, maybe.
Carrie Young, Shoshana Carrie Young, Bean.
Yeah. Marion Plunkett.
Sarah Paulson. All right. Yes. Yeah. Didn't take me much time, but I had to take a second there. Oh, that's a good list. That's a good list.
Yeah.
I don't want to take too much of your time, but I want to just ask you about there, you know, as always, there's discourse about critics and like how much power they have or don't have or should have. I used to be very much in the mix on this discourse, and I certainly follow it from the sidelines, but I feel like I can't argue about it anymore. Are you sound like you don't have enough time, you're so busy writing that it's not like you're thinking about the impact necessarily of that. But is that something you have thoughts about, like, you know, critics too mean, too nice, they have too much power, not enough?
Well, again, I haven't been doing this job for exceptionally long. But I have never gotten the sense that critics now have more power than like someone on social media who has a lot of followers. I could be wrong, but it does feel like a more democratic environment in the sense that if you like a show, you can get online and, you know, galvanize love and attention for it. You don't have to wait for some voice descendant from on top as a critic to kind of champion something. So I do feel like people have a lot of power, whether they realize it or not, to kind of advocate for theater and all these works and the artists that they love. I do feel like I read things that I think are mean, or certainly whenever a critic kind of writes about an actor's look or body, I find it wildly unnecessary. Part of what I do at Broadway News, I'm not only writing my own criticism, but there's a section in what we publish called the Broadway Review where I aggregate a lot of critics. Like, I do pull quotes essentially. And I gotta say, like, sometimes, I'm not gonna name any names, but there are things that like tweak my heart a little bit that people are allowed to publish certain things. Like, I think one of the worst things I read was, actually, let me not say it, I'll text it to you. But
just send it to me.
I'll send it to you, because I literally messaged my editor and I was like, can we cut this? Like, I know this person said this, but this is absurd. But yeah, I mean, I would encourage people to realize that, you know, a viral tweet is going to do way more than 5 stars in a critic's pick. Like, and the artist can also see that love, you know, they shouldn't only be paying attention to what critics and people who are in a very unique position that they're not paying for their theater. They're sitting very close to the front and in many ways are being catered to. Like, it's when I go to the theater not on assignment, I have a very different experience than when I'm going as a critic.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. I mean,
the whole space is, it just feels different.
It's absolutely different. And you have to realize a lot of times when people are paying for theater, they want to have a good time. And I think you kind of manifest that. When I saw Hell's Kitchen at the Public, I wasn't on assignment. And I had an incredible time. I wasn't looking too closely. I wasn't digging into Chris Diaz's book. I was like, oh my God, some of the best R&B music ever written.
Yeah.
In the musical, like no notes.
Yeah.
So, and then when I saw it on Broadway, I'm like, still great. I have notes, you know, it's a different experience.
Totally. Yeah. Is there anything you're looking forward to, Brittany, that you want to mention before we go to the interview with Kuperman's?
I'm looking forward to the awards in general. It'd be lovely to celebrate, and all the other awards that are happening, drama desks or like other people are announcing. And yeah, I'm going to say it again, 10 toes down. I'm looking forward to seeing Lempicka again. I'm going closing weekend. Unfortunately, didn't even realize it was closing weekend.
Oh man.
And I'm thoroughly looking forward to delving back into that world because I think it's a very enjoyable show.
That is awesome. I did not see this coming. The Lempicka love. That's great. I'd love to give it a little love.
I
will check it out now, almost entirely on your recommendation.
I stand by it.
Well, Brittany, it's great to talk to you. I hope to see you again at the theater and get some rest.
Yeah.
Thanks so much, Brittany.
Thanks
Happy
for your
housewarming.
Thank you.
Bye.
So now we will go to my interview with the Kuperman brothers, Rick and Jeff, directing and choreography team for stage and screen. They are currently Tony nominated for their work on The Outsiders. Some of their off-Broadway credits include Cyrano and Alice by Heart. They are also co-directing and choreographing a new immersive show with the producers of Sleep No More. So please welcome Rick and Jeff Kuperman.
Hi.
Hi, so great to have you here. Major congratulations on your Tony nomination. I'm sure you are both buzzing. How does it feel?
Thank you so much. Yeah, it's really surreal, especially with this cohort of incredible artists who we've been, you know, looking up to and admiring the work of for so many years. So it feels incredible.
Yeah, of course. And so, if you don't know, The Outsiders is about rival teen gangs in rural Oklahoma in the mid-1960s. It's a musical based on the S.E. Hinton book and the Francis Ford Coppola motion picture. The musical is directed by Danya Taymor, with a book by Adam Rapp and Justin Levine, with music and lyrics by the Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine as well. Had to get that out of the way. But fabulously choreographed by the Kuperman brothers. So you are siblings. I think that might be the first time we've had actual siblings on our podcast, which is fun. Together. So what is that like? Would you say that you were competitive growing up, or were you always like this collaborative?
I'm sure there was a little bit of competition there that, you know, pushed us each to, you know, try to excel in our own way, but it was very collaborative. We grew up dancing together. You know, in a studio, and oftentimes we're in the same pieces, performing in the same numbers. So it's a very collaborative and team effort in that respect. And we developed, you know, similar foundations and similar instincts and technique. But then we went off, you know, in our own little worlds before coming back together to give this thing a go as a, you know, as a team.
Yeah, and I would just add that collaboration is a muscle. It's something that you practice and you exercise. And certainly our collaboration, when we started out 13, 14 years ago doing this professionally, it didn't look the same as it does now. And so it's been great to be able to find our rhythm and our flow and the way that we trade on and off with one another. And it's something that comes over time.
Yeah, there's definitely that sibling bond. You're on like the same wavelength or something. But that's interesting that you guys get to work together and make it work so well, because I know plenty of siblings that probably could not work together. But why did The Outsiders feel like the right project for you?
Yeah, I mean, I remember reading The Outsiders when I was in middle school and, you know, and loving the book and
having fond memories of like just remembering that the exciting, you know, train escape or the fire and the rumble, all those iconic moments, I remember very, very well. And so when the script came across our desk, even before I read the entire thing, I already had a sense that this was something that was going to be in our wheelhouse, something that was about brotherhood, something that was about finding yourself, even amongst a group of like-minded individuals. There was an element of masculinity that really appealed to me. And as soon as I read it, I knew that we had to find a way to work on this. We had to just, whatever it took, we had to find a way to work on it.
Yeah, and I was a little late to the party when it came to The Outsiders. I apparently was living under a rock. So my first exposure to any of this material was through Adam Rapp's draft of the book. Adam, though, was someone I was very familiar with, having studied a lot of his plays in college. And I was immediately, you know, hooked by his rendition of the story. And, you know, a chance to collaborate with Danya Taymor and the rest of the creative team, it was, we knew it would be a once in a lifetime collaboration. So we were very glad to be brought on.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable. And it's really interesting because it doesn't happen every day that you have a predominantly male cast for a big musical. Obviously there are incredibly talented female cast members in the show as well. But this central male cast is just so, so talented. And it's really all about brotherhood. You know, Ponyboy is being raised by two older brothers after unfortunately, tragically losing his parents. And he's also kind of a part of this found family that's its own brotherhood of the Greasers. What was that like to choreograph for a predominantly male cast? I mean, it's not, you know, you're not doing doubles where you have a partner and a, you know, you're not ballroom dancing. You're
yeah, you know, there's a fair amount of lifting vocabulary throughout the piece, just male on male partnering, and it's cool to see that element be used on stage. But I would say that it was important to us that every member of the cast, principal, ensemble, they all had their own unique track and their own unique spin on the character, and that we wanted the choreography to support that idea and to give three-dimensionality to everyone on stage, which means that, you know, certainly there's use of unison and canon and all the, you know, formal elements of choreography, but there is a kind of looseness to a lot of the movement on stage so that every performer could retain their individuality. You know, it's certainly not the Rockettes approach that we're going for here.
Yeah, and even in the fight choreography, it's not partner dancing, but it isn't partner dancing in the way that you might think about it initially, but it is partner dancing, right? Like a fight is essentially a cooperative act on stage. You're Absolutely. You are working together to create the illusion of violence or the illusion of harm, but really it's if you don't work together, then that might become a reality. So making sure that everyone had a sense of partnership, even as we were working on those more violent aspects, it was important. And it is a masculine energy in those moments, but we do have them presenting performers doing that as well. So even though it's masculine, whatever that means, it doesn't mean that it is performed primarily or only by men, which is to say that anyone can do this sort of movement.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And I'm sure there's a lot of trust that has to be built there, because violence can be scary, even when it's staged. But how would you describe your influences for this choreography? Obviously, the concept of rival gangs and all of the climbing definitely brings West Side Story to mind. Was that on your minds at all?
I mean, for sure. Obviously, we're indebted to Jerome Robbins. It's hard to look at this material and not, you know, think about West Side Story. But but it's cool to see the final product on the stage and, you know, see where it is indebted and where it is actually its own animal and its own, you know, brand new thing. But, you know, our choreographic influences are many and diverse. We love this company, Complicité, out of the UK, and Simon McBurney's work in physical storytelling. We love this Canadian choreographer named Crystal Pike, who uses sound and movement and the synchronicity between those two, even when it's syncopated in really, really beautiful ways. You know, we love the work of Stephen Hoggett. We were very excited to meet with him. He came to see the show, so that was really cool, like meeting a, you know, a hero of ours. So there are many, many places where we draw inspiration for the work that we see on stage there. And then, of course, also, like, you know, martial arts choreography, Jackie Chan, Bruce Lee, you know, the way that they're choreographing for the camera, or for a performance, I should say, is in many ways its own technique that's separate from the, you know, utility of a martial art. So certainly that's infused its way somewhere in our subconscious.
Yeah, and you're not just, you know, professionally trained dancers, you're also black belts. I don't know if everybody knows that, but I'm sure all of that, you know, martial arts knowledge comes in handy here.
Yeah, you know, they're all movement disciplines and they all inform one another. So it was a great part of our early training, certainly.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit about how you go about portraying violence while also keeping the actors, you know, physical safety in mind. I've, you know, come across actors who are like, just hit me, it'll look more real. And not only does that violate a bunch of contracts, probably, I'm like, come back to me after 8 shows a week of getting like the snot kicked out of you and tell me that you still want to do that.
Absolutely. Yeah. So there are a few things. The first thing is that through our martial arts training and just watching a lot of shows and seeing what is successful and what is not successful, we like to make it so that we don't have to fake force, but we can redirect it and we can manipulate it and we can harness it, but we don't need to actually connect, obviously. And we don't have to try to sell something that's not real. So it's more about throws. It's more about manipulations, about, you know, pushing people around safely than it is about trying to sell a nap all the time. And then the other thing that we discovered through this process, and it's something that Rick brought up about martial arts choreography for cinema, which is that the thing that clues us into the reality of violence often is an aural cue, right? So like if you watch a martial arts movie with no sound, or if you watch a martial arts movie before it's had its Foley added, it's almost laughable. But the moment that you see the visual cue with the sound, then something stirs inside of you. So that was a big part of how we worked on the Rumble. And when we divorced the partners from fighting each other, have them face downstage and simply receive the blows, they can sell the violence that much more convincingly without actually having to do any harm or be in any danger of doing harm to anyone else.
Totally. And I'll just add that, you know, the first part of the Rumble, what we call phase one, is a more traditional take on fight choreography. We think about it as a sort of Hieronymus Bosch-like mural where you could zoom in on any particular duet or trio and see a lot of detail in that choreography, but you could also zoom out and just appreciate the wide shot of all of the action taking place simultaneously. And, you know, the performers, they really trained. We started each rehearsal with a long warm up, the way that Danya and the two of us like to start rehearsal is by really investing in that time so that we build trust, but also build muscle and build technique and build agility and build awareness. Awareness is probably one of the most important elements when you're doing a show like The Outsiders 8 times a week. So you can be inside of your track, but also know at any given moment where all of your collaborators and where your scene partners are. And not only your scene partners, but also where the scenic elements that you're manipulating are, those planks, cinder blocks, tires, that are all used simultaneously to transition the audience from location to location and from time to time inside of the story. So, you know, like I said at the top of our conversation, the way that collaboration is a muscle, you can also train yourself to build your awareness and build your agility and build your strength and all of these other things to be able to use it 8 times a week on stage on Broadway.
Yeah, it might seem strange to call it beautiful, but it's some of the most beautiful fight choreography I've seen on a stage in a while. And one of the things I love is that you're not afraid to slow the motion down. And there are some of these, you know, interjections where like Ponyboy is falling and he's saying something to the audience at the same time because he's kind of also the narrator. And you just feel it. Like when he falls, you like feel that hit because it's slower and it's like, you know, you get that kind of disoriented feeling of like everything's moving in slow motion because something bad is happening. And I just, that effect was just brilliant.
I love that call to, you know, to that slap when Daryl first lays hand on his younger brother, right? And even the way we staged it in La Jolla was very naturalistically. But we realized something that, you know, the real estate, the weight of that hit for Ponyboy, his memory, it's so outsized what actually might have happened if you were just a fly on the wall in the Curtis boys' home when Daryl lost his temper and hit his younger brother. And so, you know, we were experimenting with ways to render that on the stage. And certainly the combination of choreography and lights and sound, you know, we were able to take some of the learnings of the Rumble and then weave them throughout the entire show, the first act as well, to create this kind of vocabulary for violence.
I want to talk about the set for a second. And the word that comes to mind for me is grit, because there's this, it's kind of this junkyard jungle gym to kind of give an overview. There's all this like scaffolding and there's climbing and there's water on stage. And immediately I was like, how are they not slipping and falling? Now, obviously they are way more coordinated than I will ever be, but like, are there special shoes? I know there's something to do with pellets on the ground. Like what is happening there?
Yeah, we certainly took our time and did our research about the optimal floor and the optimal way to do the show while allowing water to drain through. And so, yeah, we experimented a lot, went to J&M, our special effects studio that was working on the show. And we have more pellets and more substances in our shoe than we care to imagine. But in La Jolla, we were working on cork that would grind down eventually and become this fine powder. So it wasn't really the optimal solution for the long term. But here we found this substance called EPDM. It provides the traction that we need while still scattering around the floor so that it has the feeling of dirt and has the feeling of grit while still being safe.
Yeah, there was this incredible like gravel effect that like really felt like a gravel driveway, at least from where I was sitting. And like there's this puddle aspect where like they're kicking up water and they're moving around and they're splashing each other, and it was just so cool, because you don't see that every day, because that takes budget and time and there's safety to think about and all of those things. So I commend you for being innovative in that way.
It was definitely a collaboration with our director Donnie Seymour and with our brilliant scenic designers Amp. It was really cool how it came together and how spare the ultimate design is, so that the bodies can really kind of be the storytellers and the focus as Ponyboy takes us through his memory.
And they didn't even have to wear like rock climbing shoes. Like they're not even like, and like they have sneakers, like normal, you know, teenage shoes. And I was expecting like, gotta have those like utility boots or something with grip. And I was like, oh, they're just doing that.
No cleats, no cleats, just sneakers.
That's So cool. It reminds me of the years ago there was a Beyonce performance that they did like all in water, and it was, I mean, they were like swimming, but it was like they had no shoes on in that performance, and I was just like, I don't know if you can be barefoot on Broadway, like that would probably hurt. But yeah, the water, I have 1,000 questions about water, but it's just fascinating the way that it's done. And then, I mean, has anyone slipped as of yet?
I'm sure, yeah, I'm sure at some point it's an inevitability with this kind of material, but it's all about just, you know, letting your scene partners catch you and bring you back up and get on with it. I think the fact that it is so bare a set and that the bodies are shining in that way, it's cool even when the little mistakes happen. You know, it's part of the,
Right.
yeah,
You're not like
I don't know.
crashing into anything. Like,
Yeah, I don't know, Jeff. You want to add anything to that?
No, I mean that's the beauty of live theater. It's live.
Yeah.
So of course, you know, of course, I've seen people slip here and there, but by and large, we've been safe.
Yeah. It's truly amazing. And I'm just like, did you rehearse with water too? Like, I can't even.
So, like I mentioned, especially with the EPDM and finding the right substance, we made a few treks over to J&M, and we were very fortunate to try out a few different configurations to understand how slippery would be, different consistencies of mud, different consistencies of blood, to see what it would do to our grip, what it would do to our traction. And you know, during one of those workshops, we brought a bunch of performers in, and we did a mini rumble in the special effects space, and we learned a lot, and we learned a lot in La Jolla about what it means when the rain doesn't go, for example, a technical error, and what it means to do the rumble in on dry land, so to speak. So by the time that we got to Broadway, we were pretty well versed, and the company had gone through water training, so to speak. So it wasn't ever really on Broadway a big point of consternation at that point.
That's
Yeah, we had to learn how to do it.
so interesting, and you're pros in it now, apparently. So speaking of what you've learned, in addition to, you know, finding the right surface to dance on in water, what else have you learned from this production and this process?
Yeah,
I think
I mean,
one.
I've
Go for it.
learned a lot of different things. You know, one piece is about expanding the collaborative muscle that, you know, Jeff and I have developed for, you know, 13, 14 years, whatever it is now, just, you know, to a larger circle, because it really takes a village to put up a musical on Broadway. So that's been cool. But also, this is actually our first Broadway show. So just understanding the ecosystem and some of the union rules, the technicalities of what it is to put up a Broadway show has been a cool learning as well.
I think I've come to appreciate how important it is to take your time with a piece of art and to let it find itself, to put it on its feet, and to continue to iterate. Sometimes things are rushed, and I understand because of the ecosystem that we work in, but I don't think this piece would have been what it is without the investment of time to break it apart, put it back together, to investigate specifically certain aspects of it. So I'm very grateful for that.
And you both have worked kind of on the fringes as well. You've done some experimental and some immersive stuff too. I hear you have a project in the works. I don't know how much you can say about it, but is there anything you would like to say or can say about what you have coming up?
Just to
You
say, no,
can't.
it's a, we can't say that much, except that it's been a joy. We've been developing it for many, many years. We're very excited for it to start to receive audiences soon. And that's about it, I guess, right, Jeff?
I mean, at the very least, it's going to be epic. It's going to be absolutely epic. And I can't wait to for the world to learn a little bit more about it soon, very soon.
Great. Okay. Everybody keep following the Koopman brothers for their new immersive thing that you will find out more about soon. And finally, like, you know, now that you've officially been nominated for a Tony, what's something that you haven't done yet that you would like to do? You know, you have this under your belt. You know that you can work with water now. What's next for the brothers? Other than this one immersive thing that you can't.
This is going right at the top of the resume. Is work with water. I love it. So, you know, Jeff and I really love movie musicals. And we love movie musicals of the golden age, but we also love, you know, more recent, more experimental movie musicals. And we really want to take a crack at directing and choreographing a feature-length film. So I think that's something we'll get working on after this immersive show opens and we take a moment to go ahead and back on.
Amazing. Jeff, anything
well said? Nah, he nailed it. 10 out of 10.
Thank you both for taking the time to talk with me. I really appreciate it. Your work is just fabulous, and I can't wait to see what you're cooking up next.
Thank you.
Best of luck in Tony season. I am rooting for you. And if you haven't seen The Outsiders on Broadway yet, get your tickets. And if you want to sit in the splash zone, sit in the front.
I love it. The grit pit.
The grit pit, they call it. Yeah.
That's awesome. Allie, thanks a lot for having us. It was a blast. Glad to meet you and to speak with you, and wishing you all the best.
Yeah,
thank you so much. Thanks.